Okay, so I'm going to start my talk with the graphs and figures I was trying to understand and the prevailing frameworks that were being lobbied around either on TV or at Left Forum and places I was going, which is not a dig to Left Forum. So the first stat, obviously, is, well, let's look at household debt as a percentage of disposable income. Well, from the 1970s, you see dramatic increases, particularly in mortgage debt, credit card debt, house, student debt, and all those three are part of this larger project which I'm working on, but this one will just focus on household debt. So household debt increasingly, in the 80s, kind of, doesn't increase as much, but particularly 1995-ish, increases dramatically tied to ownership society in terms of Bush and Clinton, both of them. And then we see household debt as a percentage of GDP. Likewise, that increases dramatically, you know, basically doubles, it almost becomes 100%. And then at the same time, we see homeowners' equity as a percentage of actual home value declining slowly, and then obviously with the crisis to some extent, starts to bottom out. At the same time, all these processes, so in terms of household debt to GDP, equity going down, household debt to disposable income increasing, homeownership rates are actually fairly stagnant. There's not a huge explosion, and if we can say a move from 64% to 69% is a huge increase. Even then, that hasn't really happened until, once again, 1995-ish. So there's not necessarily a huge explosion in actual homeownership rates when basically about every decade from the 1970s, you have a doubling of the actual value in terms of total mortgage debt. And obviously from 70 to 80, it's much more than a doubling. But so you go from $285 billion in 1970 to $10 trillion in 2009. And then the last figure is, between 89 and 2004, all the household debt taken on in the United States is largely a middling class phenomenon. The bottom 40% not involved in the vast majority of it. You know, they took on 8.9%, and then the top 1%. And so we have a large, huge middling class which takes on a majority of this debt. And then, so this is just, you know, we have all these processes going on. To a certain extent, looking at them, they seem kind of contradictory and antagonistic. I'm trying to put them together. And these are the dominant things being thrown around. One, you obviously had a very individualistic logic, which is very moralistic in terms of, you know, consumers took on more on their fair share. They knew they were taking on bad loans, but they took it on anyway. Lenders were just greedy and wanted to make as much money as possible, and so they were tricking people into it. And lots of that was largely in terms of this individual's doing this, this individual's doing that, not tied to a larger structural framework in terms of political and economic relations, cultural frameworks, or history. And so the other frameworks were structural logic. One was unregulated capitalism, largely in terms of, you know, the mortgage crisis wouldn't have happened if we hadn't undone certain types of financial legislation, those types of things, so lack of government oversight. And then the other one was kind of traditional Marxian economic structuralism, which is the mortgage crisis, obviously, is the outcome of issues of overproduction, underconsumption, and tied to this overaccumulation of capital. For me, none of these really worked or made sense. And they weren't necessarily focusing on what's going on and what's changing, particularly in terms of class relations and particularly in terms of proletarian labor relations. And they particularly weren't looking at how the wage relation and the debt relation is fused under neoliberalism and how this is central to rethinking what's the dominant class relation or position within neoliberalism in the US. And so in this sense, one of the key things I'm contending, obviously, is you see the reemergence of what presumably was an archaic class relationship, debt peonage, and how you see the emergence and fusion of debt peonage and wage laboring produces what I call the wage debt peonage, which also I'm referring to as a process of de or sub-proletarianization, which will then get me to the conclusion, which I talk about conceptions of free versus unfree labor. What is central here, obviously, is that homeownership was central to Keynesianism, and it's also central to neoliberalism, but in different ways. And one of the key things is that I root this transformation from wage labor to wage debt peonage and the debt bargaining proletarian to the crisis of the 60s and 70s. And so in that sense, I follow an autonomous Marxist framework and some of the work of Stanley Aronowitz, where in terms of class struggle and class relations are central, there's no automatic process of accumulation that capital does by itself. And so looking at those power struggles. So in the 60s, wage labor is a dominant form. Home ownership is largely tied to expanding commodity production. And that becomes a key mechanism of social integration, particularly along concepts of whiteness. Italians, Irish, all ethnic whites become whites through home ownership. And there's an expanding middle class, and it's largely framed around wage labor. Neoliberalism, that whole concept of the family wage, the productivity wage, integrating through that gets ruptured, and it becomes integration through financialization, debt relations. I contend that's tied back to how financial capital sees individuals as opposed to industrial capital, which is a problematic bifurcation, but I use it. Industrial capital, the primary identity through which it sees us as people is wage laborers. Financial capital's primary identity is as debtors. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean you can't combine the two, but the combinations would be different. Where obviously for industrial capital, wage laborers is a primary, and also you need debt to maintain certain types of consumption. But under finance capital, the debt relation becomes primary, wage relation becomes secondary, and I contend that the debt relation is central to reproducing the wage relation today. So what happens then is all the demands of the 60s in terms of for wages decoupled from production, for waging unwaged work in terms of if you think of the welfare rights movement, all those demands, which are social reproduction demands, i.e. I want income to pay bills, put food on the table, those things, maybe afford education for my child for college, most of those are reoriented as consumption demands. And so neoliberalism does a toxic mimic where it perverts the intent and the desire of those demands and reframes them, largely because all I can see us as is debtors or wage laborers and not actually as real human people. And so when I say it's a process of deproletarianization, which some of my academic mentors don't like, is this is how historically or the literature that went through deproletarianization is used. And Tom Brass's work I actually include a lot in my own. It's very fascinating. Plantation owners historically attempted to prevent slaves and workers from becoming a proletariat, i.e. becoming freed from the land and becoming wage labor. And so the struggles around that were the inability to realize themselves and the failure of the struggles and the capacity of landlords to keep them as slaves or as debt-bonded individuals is seen as a process of deproletarianization. The creation of communes and cooperatives when people leave, the welfare state, Burleigh talks about it, the process of decommodification, but also Wright has written several articles, that's just one of them, on self-employment as a process of deproletarianization. I am not talking about any of those, where in terms of some of those have positive connotations. I talk about it a lot in terms of Adrienne and, is it Geneva?
Genevieve.
Okay.
It's called G.
Where in terms of, if we're talking about debt becomes a central mechanism of curtailing the power, autonomy, desires of the waged and unwaged working class in the United States in the 60s and 70s. It comes out after the decomposition phase of breaking down unions, welfare state, deindustrialization, all of that. There's a second component going on behind the scenes, but really comes to head in the later 80s, particularly in the 90s and the 2000s, is the reintegration, recomposition through financialization. And so it's about restricting that ability to one, negotiate within the labor market, but also leave the labor market entirely. And so when we say depoletarianization, I'm not talking about people actually regain ownership over the means of production. They have some type of relative autonomy from the labor market, i.e. subsistence farmers or self-employed individuals. It's all about the militancy, capacity, all those types of things. And in that sense, when I say you're a wage debt peon, you've largely lost the capacity to sell or not sell your labor power. You have to Okay, so debt peonage historically. Debt peonage historically is largely a class relation where debt becomes central to obtaining, maintaining, and keeping a labor force. And so as a worker, you're not able to leave, renegotiate those terms of contract, because debt circumscribes that ability to, one, refuse that relationship, renegotiate, or exodus, which is leave that relationship entirely and create non-capitalist social relations. Okay, cool. That said, five, I would have issues. 10 minutes, cool. So all of this obviously is in relation to the conception of having a free and clear position. So how do you actually get someone to be bonded by debt? Well, historically, the general tactics are you pay them below subsistence wages, or you give them cash advance up front, which then, in combining with below subsistence wages, they can never get out of it. Also, or if you're a merchant lender, you charge extremely exorbitant prices on the items you buy. So if you think of like the traditional kind of company town or factory town store, that would be a manifestation of that. But one of the key things to think about here is generally, it's particularly in terms of, if you think about this in the relationship to agrarian capitalism or agrarian societies, it's typically seen as debt peonage as something that's about the rural area, not the urban, and about agricultural producers and food producers. I mean, one of the key things also is that even in liberal discourse, the assumption obviously is that capitalism is the most liberatory of all social relations. You have autonomy, you have choice. And really, the emergence of capitalism, if you think about it in markets, if you think about it in quantification, if you think about it in terms of wage labor, actually is predicated upon the relationship between wage labor, slavery, and debt peonage. Well, in terms of the 18th and 19th centuries, you see the climactic effervescence of the slave trade, but also you see debt peonage in Southeast India and South Latin America. You see it in the United States, post-Reconstruction in terms of sharecropping. In that sense, we can't see wage labor as disconnected from those other processes and vice versa. The issue, which historically becomes important, is how those combine together. So when I talk about post-industrial debt peonage or today, there's similar things that occur historically. So in terms of, if you think about the movement from feudalism to capitalism, it's a movement away from bonded labor to the conception of a labor market. Well, in the labor market, the presumed force and compulsion is economic, not political. Well, in terms of, it's depersonalized, you don't have a person, an individual there telling you, forcing you to work, threatening necessarily body and violence and body harm. There's also, to some extent, customs on both ends in terms of mutual obligations. Just like there's a move from that to the labor market, within here, your debt, and this is also to some extent new historically, your debt and your labor time are owned by different institutions, not just individuals. And so that obviously can, one, become problematic if you're thinking about how do you do anti-debt struggles. Because one, now they're totally depersonalized. You don't have your landlord or your merchant lender of credit banging down your door on a daily basis. You have this huge bureaucratic mechanism where people, they send you papers and all those types of things. So there's that process in terms of the decoupling and depersonalization in terms of the ownership of those two different aspects. You're also not paying it back in labor time or in-kind services. You're largely paying it back in wages, so income you get from jobs, or more and more people are paying back debt with debt. So you're swapping one credit card for another, those types of things. And my whole thing is, one of my things, is for debt peonage, people are affixed to land, but not agrarian rural land. You're affixed to land, i.e. the home you own. And so that severely, that becomes a new mechanism of entrapment. And while it does, to some extent, there's qualitative and quantitative differences, historically, you're still attached to land because this becomes a key thing. Your mobility is restricted. Another key thing is, historically, debt peonage was used to accumulate surplus value through commodity production. Today, debt's largely about money interest generation. And so the commodity production is to a certain extent secondary. And so in that sense, why debt peonage is occurring is not about the former surplus value versus commodity production, but about money interest generation. And so I kind of dealt with that, how it works. In the US, it's similar to traditional mechanisms, and that's why I'm using the language of debt peonage for 5 minutes, is the continuity is the same. If you look from the 70s to today, you have a massive forcing down of the personal, but also the social wage. You then have massive expansion and liberalization of the credit apparatus to keep cheap credit available. You force prices up, so you see massive inflation in the housing market. And so to mediate the forcing prices up, forcing wages down, you mediate that with credit. Well, that's a traditional mechanism for debt peonage. And in that sense, neoliberalism is not just a disciplinary apparatus shaped around wage labor, but also debt becomes a key mechanism to force people into coming back and selling themselves as cheapened wage labor. I already discussed that. And so this becomes central and this I'm drawing upon Tom Grass, amongst others, also Dale Tomich. So historically, unfree labor is presumed to be able to unsell the labor at will, and generally tied to for a finite amount of time, maybe convict labor, indentured servitude, or to infinite duration, your chattel slavery. And so when Grass talks about it, he's like, well, free labor is really about the potential to commodify and recommodify one's labor, which obviously means your ability to be free of bondage to land or an individual. But one of the key things within this is then that unfree labor, then, one of the key things that's not discussed as much is that's not just the capacity to commodify or recommodify, but the capacity to decommodify yourself, i.e. remove yourself from the labor market entirely. And obviously that's one of the key kind of struggles historically is, if you look at colonialism, a lot of people didn't want to work for the new colonial landlords, so you had a politics largely of exodus. I'm going to go be a subsistence individual community grower. And so there's always mechanisms to bring them back in, largely through hut taxes, poll taxes, those types of things. So unfree laboring relations encompass not just the inability to commodify yourself, but the inability to decommodify yourself. So it's not just about entering the labor market, but being able to exit the labor market. And this touches upon a lot of the stuff you two were talking about. And so if the individual is unable to decommodify their labor power because of debts owed to their employer, or a lender of credit, then we can't be considered free labor at all. And so we would all be unfree labor. And obviously this becomes important in terms of Marx documents a lot in terms of, well, wage labor is just another form of coerced or bonded labor historically. And in that sense, there's a continuity between slavery and serfdom and those types of things, as opposed to necessarily an entirely clean break. And so, going back to what I said at the beginning, wage labor doesn't necessarily operate on the other end of, outside of, an opposition to coerced labor or debt peonage or slavery, but can be reconfined in new forms, since most of those relations, laboring relations, are hybrid, contingent, fluid. There's no unitary or linear trajectory from one to the other. Because if you read traditional Marxian stuff, it's like, oh, we are peasants and then we become proletariats, and that's better than the last thing, but like that's the goal, as opposed to now you see a lot of mixed combinations of people doing wage work and self-employment and subsistence production, particularly at the household or community level. And so, also, rather than presuming that unfree or bonded laboring relations are antagonistic to the capital relation. How much time do I have left?
I mean, we have like an hour for discussion.
Okay, well, I'll wrap this up. So rather than presuming that unfree or bonded laboring relations are antagonistic to the capital relation and will somehow inhibit surplus value accumulation, wage labor is not always the most productive laboring form. And it's important to situate why certain laboring forms exist in that struggle between surplus production, appropriation, and distribution. If workers become too mobile or too powerful vis-a-vis the employers of the state employers will often seek out a less powerful mixed or more fixed group of workers to accelerate accumulation. And so this is what has led me to theorize this new wage debt peonage and rooting it back in the Great Refusal, where there was a lot of mobility, a lot of antagonism surrounding that capital labor relationship, and there were lots of processes of decommodification ongoing, which were not seen as viable by neoliberals, neoconservatives, states. And so you see this new class relationship and class positions develop in order to attempt to facilitate a new wave of accumulation for certain factions of capital, not necessarily all forms of capital benefit equally. And that's one of the important things to think is once industrial capital and finance capital to six and have internal fights over how we can distribute the surplus, you can have large internal wars and fracases too.